these people, most of them are in the audience, together with a little bit of work in progress about first sound of zero temperature holographic superfluids. So brief outline. I will review the effective theory for superfluids, even though Alberto did that already the very first day, and its gravity dual. Then I'll describe what's our setup, how our background fields look like. And then from there, I'll go into the core of the business, which is essentially a method to explicitly compute analytically the boundary action for the superfluid phonons starting from the bulk fields. And then I'll close with comments and a little bit of a description of what we are planning on doing in the next future. Okay, so I'm sure we all know that zero temperature superfluids can be considered as systems where a spontaneously broken U1 symmetry is at finite density. Now, arguably, the easiest description of this system is in terms of a single real field. And this field has essentially two properties. First one is that it shifts under the U1 symmetry, right, this way. And second property is that it gets a time-dependent vacuum expectation value that breaks Lorentz. And then now that this is given, the fluctuation of this field around the background are going to be our Goldstone bosons, which is the superfluid phonon. Now, given these symmetries, the most general action that you can write is of this form here, where P is some function, but it must be a function solely of this quantity. And this quantity has clearly the property of being Lorentz invariant, translational invariant, and lowest order in energy, because this is a low energy theory. Okay, very nice. Given the action, we can write down the stress tensor, which is of this form. Now, as I said, in general, P is completely general, but since we want to work with ADS-CFT, we are interested in the conformal case. So if you impose for the trace of T to be zero, that actually constrains P, the Lagrangian, up to an overall factor to be just x to the d over 2. And consequently, this also forces the speed of first sound to be 1 over the square root of the number of spatial dimensions. Okay, so a slightly different description of the same system actually involves a complex field now, whose phase is the previous field phi, and a constant gauge field whose only non-zero component is along the time direction. Now, once this is given, the field capital phi now transforms under U1 with an usual phase. The time derivatives are shifted, and we don't have to require a dev for small phi anymore. Now, once we have this new description of the same system, reading off the ADS-CFT dictionary is much simpler, and so the holographic dual is clearly scalar QED on asymptotical ADS background. Now, let me start now by saying that this is all well known. There are plenty of works about that. We are just rediscovering the wheel. But most of these works are based on numerical arguments. Well, I'll show you a method that is analytic and is actually, in my opinion, fairly simple and very explicit to build the boundary action for the phonon starting from the bulk. And as I'll argue in a second, or well, maybe a few minutes, but we hope to be able to apply this method to other situations. Okay? So that's more like a toy model. And I should also mention that this is not the first time that a method like that appears. In particular, it's been developed already by these people to describe the EFT of holographic fluids, with the main difference that in this case, the background fields, their detail is known, the expression, while in our case, we'll be able to solve all the equations and compute the boundary action without actually knowing the mathematical expression for the boundary fields, the background fields. Okay, so the setup is the usual one, scalar QED with a certain counter term and a potential that will be mostly generic. We'll take the potential to be mass term plus interactions. We work in the probe limit, meaning we neglect back reaction. And since we want to work at zero temperature, we take our background metric to be just ADS in these coordinates. And now there is a pretty big disclaimer. There are studies that include the full back reaction that show that for certain potentials, this approximation is a bad one. And in particular, there are situations where the geometry near the IR is not conformally invariant anymore. Okay? So when that's the case, meaning for those potentials, our approximation is bad, and this argument doesn't work. But nevertheless, the same works show that there are some potentials, say, for example, massless free field, or the Mexican hat at large charge, for which even including the Fullback reaction, we have conformal symmetry both in the UV and in the IR. The fields stay finite, and so our approximation is consistent. So from here on, whenever you see V, we have to assume that it's one of those potentials that allow this approximation. Okay. Well, I'm setting the ADS radius to 1, but yes, in principle, the ADS radius changes, but it changes by terms that are dependent on the fields, on the matter fields. As long as you neglect back reactions, those terms are negligible, and so you can take the radius to be constant. There is an explicit formula on that. Essentially, it changes with the potential of the scalar field. But if the potential is much smaller than everything else because you are neglecting back reaction, everything is consistent. Okay, so this is the usual setup for the background fields. Everything is plane symmetric. The complex field is actually real on the background, and the gauge field has the only non-zero component to be the time one. Now don't worry about this funky expression, it's just for later convenience. And as usual, we read off the quantities of the boundary theory from the falloffs of the scalar of the matter fields, and we work in a quantization with this counter term such that the first falloff of the matter field is the source of the operator, of the charged operator, and the second is the BEV. And since we want spontaneous breaking of the U1, we always set rho 1 equal to 0 from now on. Okay, then you can write down the equations of motion for the background, nothing fancy, and we won't solve them because we are not able to do that analytically. So they're just there. After that, we can go to the core of the business, meaning we go to next order and we fluctuate our bulk fields around the background. We parameterize the fluctuations this way, okay? You can write down the quadratic action. It's a little bit ugly, but it's nothing special. And now, once this is given, we want to do the following. We'll write down the linearized equation for these fluctuations. So not only a linear order in the fluctuations themselves, but also a lowest order in boundary derivatives, because we want a low energy theory on the boundary. And I'll show you that we are able to solve these equations for all the fluctuations but pi, the phase of the scalar field. And in particular, we'll solve them with double vanishing Dirichlet boundary conditions. So all the fluctuations will be zero, both at u equals zero and u equal infinity. Once that is done, we plug the solutions back into this action, which will turn out to be just a boundary term, and in particular, it will be the right boundary term that we expect for a superfluid. Okay. And let me stress again, and even though we don't know how the background looks like, we can still like go on with our project all the way to the end. Okay, so we write down the equations of motion. This is the linearized version and lowest order in energy. In particular, the low energy expansion is performed with this prescription here. So all the fluctuations and the derivatives with respect to the radial component of the ADS space are order 1. Derivatives with respect to the boundary theory are order epsilon. And then since the Goldstone boson and also alpha u for consistency always appear derived with respect to a boundary derivative, we have to make them count 1 over epsilon. So these are the equations, very nice. Ah, and let me say now that we didn't fix any gauge, and indeed we are not going to fix the gauge until the end. Nothing changes if you do, but we didn't fix the gauge. The very last equation tells you right away that the phase pi is related to the radial component of the gauge field that way. And as you'll see in a minute, our Goldstone boson for the boundary theory is just the boundary value of pi, which is the Wilson line of the radial component of the gauge field. Okay. So these are the solution for the equations of motion of the fluctuations. As you see, they do depend on the background, psi and rho, but they don't explicitly depend on their analytical form, and they all vanish at u equals zero and infinity. Actually, in this case, provided that the background fields decrease fast enough near the IR. It's an assumption, but it's at least an assumption that is verified in those two examples I was telling you before. So massless scalar field and Mexican hat at large charge. So we have at least two examples in which this works. And now if you plug these guys back into the quadratic equation action that I showed you before, meaning these, you can play a little bit with integration by parts and stuff like that, and you recover an action that is just a boundary term, and it's actually the right boundary term, because this is the action for free phonons in a conformal superfluid, and in fact has the right dispersion relation, 1 over square root of d minus 1. Also note that this is not, strictly speaking, the action. I'm not saying that the dual theory is a theory of free phonons. It's simply that we are still not good enough to compute non-quadratic terms that would be interactions of the phonons. Okay, so this is our main result, but I should probably comment on it a little bit. The first thing to say is that our approach does not work for the d equal 2 case, and the reason is that the background fields are not regular anymore. But nevertheless, we don't expect Goldstone bosons for d equal 2 anyways for Coleman's theorem, so that should be fine. Also, with our convention, epsilon and mu, meaning the charge density and the chemical potential, have the same sign, and this ensures that this prefactor is positive, and so pi is not ghost-like, which is good. And lastly, the interpretation of the boundary Goldstone boson in terms of Wilson line of the radial gauge field of the bulk is actually pretty common. I mean, I'm sure that most of the people in the audience expected that already. I didn't, but anyways. And it's been found, for example, for an Einstein-Maxwell theory, ordinary holographic fluids, holographic QCD, composite Higgs. So it's very well known. So we believe that since our method is very explicit, it's analytic and is actually independent of the detailed knowledge of the background, it can be used to A, study the low energy boundary dual of a given bulk theory, but it can also be used to resolve some old issues, which I'll describe in a second. And in particular, this is what we would like to do in the near future. A first idea that we have is to study the finite temperature case rather than the zero temperature case. The EFT for finite temperature superfluid is known. And as well as it's known, the gravity dual, which is supposed to be against scalar QED, but now you want a source for the non-zero temperature of the boundary theory, and so you put everything on a black hole background. With only one problem, there are numerical studies that, starting from this system here, as I was saying, weren't able to reproduce Landau's prediction for the relation between second and first sound at low temperature. In particular, Landau tells us that when T is almost zero, second sound and first sound should be related in this way. And numerically, from this system, you're not able to reproduce that relation. And the same authors actually claim that this might be due to the presence of additional degrees of freedom in your boundary theory. Now, if that's true, the question is the following. Can we apply our method to this system and try to recover the known EFT for finite temperature superfluids? And if not, can we isolate these additional degrees of freedom and see what went wrong? Okay, this is idea number one. And idea number two is to study the holographic dual of a solid. Someone in the audience already has some idea about that. We want to take somehow like a complementary approach. Now, you know that if you're in d-dimensional flat space, the symmetry of a solid is iso-d cross iso-d, spontaneously broken to the diagonal subgroup. With the only problem that this group here is non-compact, so if we want to gauge it to write down the bulk theory, we can't use Young-Mills. We have to do something else. But if we are really lazy and we really love Young-Mills, what we can do is to put our solid on a sphere. Now, when you are on a sphere, space translation now becomes just one additional rotation. So your group goes from iso-d to so-d plus 1, which is not compact, and the DSEFT dictionary tells us that the dual of this guy should be a non-abelian Young-Mills theory. So what we are trying to do now is to apply this same method to check if we can recover the EFT for a solid starting from a non-abelian so-d plus 1 gauge theory in the bulk. And so this is my summary, but I think I already said most of it, so thanks.
I did spend a comment about this excitation. I mean, I think I would call this second sound, not the first sound.
No, but we're working at zero temperature.
Right, but this is the sound wave associated with the Goldstone boson.
No, this is the Goldstone boson.
Right, precisely. I mean, I think this is conventionally called second sound.
You know,
first sound would be like a pressure wave.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be associated with like metric perturbations in your gravity theory.
But at zero temperature, there's only
exactly.
one sound, no?
Yeah.
Or zero temperature is superfluid.
Yeah, it's not as logical as that. I mean, it doesn't have to be a first sound, but the second sound would be the second sound.
What are you talking about?
Also, in some awfully pathological cases, like where it's not shown the zero temperature, there is a metric norm for zero temperature.
No, but in a superfluid at zero temperature, this sound is really a pressure wave, no? Somehow when you go from the transition temperature to zero temperature, they exchange role, what you call first sound and second sound.
But that's because you're assuming that there are normal fluids,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Here, there's
no. I'm not sure that that's true.
There's definitely another model.
There's a metric.
But in our case, if we neglect back reaction, the only fluctuation that you have is the fluctuation of the phase, no?
No, as you say, but there is sometimes, it's very minor, but there is sometimes another mode, so it's probably best to call this sound.
It's one of the sounds.
And so do you think that, for example, hydroactive terms could also be...
Sorry, what did you say?
Do you think that hydroactive terms in the effective action could also be obtained similarly?
We have to work on it because it's so the method itself is fairly linear, right? The big difficulty comes from finding these solutions in terms of the background fields without knowing the background fields. If you start including higher derivative terms, the equations become more and more complicated. Maybe if you're good enough, you can solve them and still find interactions and stuff like that. But so far, that's the most basic thing we can know, but I don't exclude that you would be able to do that if you're good enough.
So just in principle, how would dissipation arise in this context?
Oh, that's a good question. You should probably have to put, I don't know, some additional terms in the bulk, and that would give you dissipative terms in the boundary, I guess, no?
But at zero temperature, you don't expect this.
Yeah, I'm saying for that.
No, if you want to do the finite, yes.
So in your finite expression, this Q, so Q, what is it in your...
Q is the charge of the scalar field in the bulk.
Why is it a free parameter, meaning probably you can choose, you can make a choice, no?
For Q?
Yeah.
But I mean, like, whatever these prefactors... First of all, as long as you don't have interactions here, everything can be reabsorbed in the definition of the field. So, like, you need higher order terms to actually fix the overall factor.
That's right. I suppose you're strong enough to compute interactions, then there shouldn't be any free parameter apart from the chemical potential, no? The effective action.
Probably. But maybe once you include the interaction, you can eat up Q.
More questions. Okay, just think hands again.